We're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 13 today. This is the third discourse of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. There are five of these that we're looking at in this class. The first one was the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. The second discourse was the Limited Commission, Matthew chapter 10, that we looked at the last couple of weeks. And this morning we're going to begin looking at the third discourse, which is found in Matthew chapter 13. I had asked you to read this chapter in preparation. What do you notice about Matthew 13? What is specific about this discourse, the type of talking that Jesus is doing? What do we see here, a collection of? Yeah, these are parables. Matthew 13 is pretty much nothing but parables. And what you see in chapter 13 and verse 1 is, he says, on the same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea, and great multitudes were gathered together to him, so that he got into a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. Then he spoke many things to them in parables. And chances are that what we have recorded for us in Matthew 13 is not everything that he would have said. Because if you just take this and you just read it through, and you'll see, even as we go through this, that there's a break in the action and he goes to a different location. Well, so if you take just what he said in the boat by the sea while the people were on the seashore, that would have taken all of, 5-10 minutes. That's not many things. So there is probably a whole lot more than he said that Matthew does not record for us, but he takes these things and collects them together into what we call this third discourse of Jesus. And again, let me call your attention to the statement that is made that delineates the end of each of these discourses. We see this with each one. At the end of chapter 13, verse 53, it says, "Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these parables that he departed from there." That's that kind of statement that Matthew makes every time. Now, when he had finished saying these things, when he had finished these sayings, when he had finished these teachings, when he had finished these parables, he went and did such and such. That's the mark of the end of that discourse. Okay, so this passage, this particular discourse, is marked by the use of parables. And something else that is true about this, that's different than some of the other discourses, is the main audience. Go back to Matthew chapter 5, and what do we see at the beginning of that discourse, the Sermon on the Mount, as being the main audience? Who is it that Jesus is talking to? Matthew 5, verse 1, "You had the multitudes there, he sees them, he goes up on a mountain, and when he was seated, who was it that came to him and that he was talking to?" The disciples. Okay, not the multitudes. He was not addressing the multitudes. They were there and they were listening. But he was addressing the disciples, and he spoke to them and taught them, saying, and he goes on into his discourse. But in Matthew 13, this is specifically addressed to the multitudes. And because it's the multitudes and because it's not the disciples, that's why he uses parables, as we're going to see. Okay, he uses a different form of teaching with the multitudes than he does with the disciples. Okay, so before we get started, any questions or comments, observations maybe from your reading or anything you want to say before we begin? Yes, sir. I think it's just a transitional statement. Just Matthew is saying that this happened and then this happened and so forth, and he's just, while chronology and timed events are not usually that important in Jewish writings, obviously there are times where it is, but I think it's just a matter of transition from the previous things to now he's going out here that happened to be the same day as these previous things took place. Now he goes out here and he's teaching the multitudes. Okay, so We have the multitudes gathered together with him. And when we think multitude, we don't need to think just a couple hundred even, but there is room on in this area that is a natural amphitheater. And you may recall, I talked about this a year ago. When we went through the parables class, it was last year, July, August, and September of last year. And I even showed you some of the pictures of the area. It is this natural amphitheater to where when you're down on the shore, and especially if you were out on the lake a little bit in a boat, of course, that helps with the voice carrying. You know, when you're on water, your voice carries a whole lot easier. And it would have been very easy for a multitude to hear Jesus speak these things. And there's plenty of room for thousands of people there. And I have no idea exactly how many, but we're not talking about just a couple hundred people. We're talking probably in the thousands that would be listening. Anytime we see that about multitudes, that's really what we need to be thinking of. So he begins with what we know as the parable of the sower. He calls it the parable of the sower. Sometimes it's called the parable of the soils. Well-known parable to most of us here. And I want you to notice, and I want you to think, put yourself in the position of the multitudes. You're here to hear what he has to say. And he starts talking about farming and agriculture. And he says, sower went out to sow in the field. Some of the seed fell by the wayside. Birds came, devoured them. In other words, didn't have time to get in the dirt and germinate. Some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth. Don't imagine in your mind soil with a bunch of loose rocks. Now, this would be like the bedrock that's just with just a little bit of a layer of soil on top of it. The stony places, they did not have much earth. They immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth, but sun came up and scorched them and they withered away. Some of the seed fell amongst thorns, and the thorns came up and choked out the plant, the crops. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some hundredfold, some 60, and some 30. And then he uses the phrase that we see he used with the churches in Revelation. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And that's all he says. Sower went out and sowed some seed, and some of it did good, some of it did bad. Listen to what I'm saying. And if you're a first century Jew, you got to be scratching your head wondering, what on earth is he talking about? What does this have to do with anything? I know how to farm. I do this all the time. I know exactly what you're talking about, but what's the point? And Jesus is making an indication with that last statement, he who has ears to hear, let him hear, that there's obviously something else that he is talking about. There's some deeper meaning to this, that he's not just talking about agriculture. But he doesn't give an explanation, does he? The multitudes don't ever hear any kind of explanation about the parable of the sower. But who does? His disciples. Why did they hear the explanation? Why were they told the explanation? Because they asked. Fast forward to verse 10 is not fast forward, it's the next verse. But he's asking them, why do you speak to them in parables? And we're going to talk about verse 10 through 17 in just a moment. But in verse 18, he then explains, and this is to the disciples, the meaning of the parable of the sower. But the multitudes don't get that information. It's the disciples who come to him and talk with him about this. We see a similar situation with the parable of the tares, the wheat and the tares. Look at verse 24. We'll come back to the parable of the sower in just a moment, but I want you to see this. He talks about, in verse 24, it says, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field, but then the enemy came along and sowed tares. Okay, we'll talk more in depth in just a moment about this, but he gives this parable, And there are a couple of other parables he gives immediately afterwards. The parable of the mustard seed, verse 31 and 32. Parable of the leaven, verse 33. And verse 36, the multitude is sent away. They go into the house. So now we're in a smaller group of people. It's just the disciples. We don't know how many. At least 12. But we don't know exactly how many people were there. And they come to him and say, explain to us the parable of the tares of the field. And he gives the explanation. But it's only these two, and it's only to the disciples. What's the significance of that in light of verses 10 and following? And we'll see this now. They ask, why do you speak to them in parables? And sum up his answer. Somebody sum up his answer for me. Why does Jesus speak in parables? Why did he say he was doing it? Okay, people knew what the parables meant even before he said it. Okay, well, actually, I believe the indication is that they did not know.
They were farmers.
Oh, they understood the illustrations maybe or the what he was drawing from. Okay, but the indication is that they wouldn't have known the ultimate meaning behind what Jesus was saying. Even the disciples didn't understand it, which is why they came and asked. But could have been. Yeah. Yes. Okay. What Jesus points out to his disciples when they ask him the question, why are you speaking in parables, is because these people are spiritually dull, to use the words that Karen just used and that Jesus himself uses here, quoting from Isaiah in verse 15, they are spiritually dense. Now you would think that, well, if somebody is spiritually dense, spiritually dull, then they would need something spoken plainly to them rather than in a parable, which makes it even more difficult to understand. So why would Jesus then do it in a more difficult way rather than in a more open and explanatory way? Why would he choose something that would be even more difficult for people who are spiritually dull? Okay. Yeah. The Jews of Jesus' day were the same as the Jews of Isaiah's day, which is why he draws from this quotation in Isaiah chapter 6. When God calls Isaiah to be a prophet, he tells him, and we saw this in the Wednesday night class just a few Wednesday nights ago, God tells him, you're going to go preach to these people, but they're not going to listen to a word you have to say. And I want you to preach to them and tell them all these things, but they're not going to listen. They're not going to see. They're going to harden their hearts. And the Jews were just like that. And what it served a purpose of was weeding out or separating the chaff from the wheat. It was finding those who were truly spiritually interested. And those who would put forth the effort, like David said, those who would desire to know what it is that Jesus wanted, what he was trying to say, well, they would come and ask. They would be ones to pursue what it is that Jesus had in mind. Those who were satisfied with their dull senses, they just went their way, and it never really changed them. And so that's what he's getting at here in verses 10 through 17. He says, for you, disciples, it's been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. To them it has not been given. It's not that Jesus or that God does not want them to know and to learn, to understand and to repent, but he recognizes there are those who are not going to. For whoever has, to him more will be given. He will have abundance, but whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Well, what is it that the disciples had that the multitudes did not have? Okay. They had the desire. They had faith in Jesus. They didn't fully understand everything, of course, but they had a desire to understand.
There's a place also where Christ, you know, once at one point said, "You've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood."
Yes, John chapter 6. Exactly. Roger is referring to John chapter 6 and the statement about him being the bread of life, and you've got to eat my blood and drink, and eat my flesh, and drink my blood. And many people turned away. They didn't understand. They thought, it's too hard of an understanding. This is weird. This guy's a wacko. But the disciples, and Peter speaking on behalf of the apostles there, says, you've got the words of life. They may not have understood it all, but they had the desire to understand. They had the desire to follow Jesus. They knew that there was something special about him. They knew he was sent by God. They didn't understand all that entailed, but they were willing to make that effort, whereas the general populace of Jews was not. And so therefore, Jesus says, those who have that kind of desire, those who have that faith, those who have that will to learn from me and follow me, you're going to be given more. Those who don't have that, well, whatever he does have is going to be taken away. And so I speak to them in parables, he says in verse 13, because they don't see, even though they have eyes. And even though they have ears, they're not hearing and they don't understand. And so the same thing that was true with the disciples with the Jews in Isaiah's day was true with them, where God says to Isaiah about the Jews, hearing you will hear and shall not understand, and seeing you will see and not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull, their eyes are hard of hearing, and their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn so that I should heal them. Have you ever had a conversation with someone, doesn't matter the subject, but you're trying to get them to see something that maybe to you is obvious, something that you understand, that they disagree with, and you can just tell from the look on their face, they ain't listening, and it doesn't matter what you say, they ain't going to change their mind. Ever had that happen? Karen says, like in children. And you can show them, you can demonstrate, you can tell them all this stuff, but they're not listening, and their minds are made up. And so even what happens is the more you talk, and the more you try to show, and the more you try to teach, the more they close up, and the harder their hearts get. What happened with Pharaoh? His heart was hardened. He hardened it, and God hardened it, not through some method that was against his free will, but, I mean, how many times did it take before Pharaoh finally got it? That's a trick question, by the way. When he was drowned, yeah. He never did really get it until, I mean, now he gets it, doesn't he? He understands now. But even after the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, and he said, all right, fine, go, he still didn't get it. And he changed his mind and went after them. Okay, his heart was hardened. It doesn't matter what God showed him. He wasn't going to listen. He wasn't going to understand. He wasn't going to believe. And that's what the parables do, is they sift out those who are willing to have a heart that's palliable, and eyes that will see and ears that will hear. And he says in verse 16, but blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For surely I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. In other words, you're living disciples in an age that those of old long wished to see. You're blessed because you're living in this time of the fulfillment of all the prophecies. And they see it. They're hearing it. Okay, does that make sense? Questions or comments about that?
Mm-hmm.
Karen is saying that with Jesus in the parables, he used things from their modern day life that they could relate to, and that should at least spark an interest in people to then try to understand what it is he's wanting to say and the point he's getting across. Of course, the problem is, as we've talked about, that most of them did not respond to that and just had the hard hearts. But those he used these illustrations or these circumstances from common everyday life in order to get across a point. But they had to search for it because he never tells them the explanation. They would have had to come to him. They would have had to think about it, meditate on it, chew on it, and try to figure out what it was he was trying to say.
Right. Perfectly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on the one hand, he was trying to weed out the people who weren't going to put in the effort. Do you think on the other hand, he might be weeding out people that were going to put in, trying to twist scriptures and trying to change things to the point that they are able to take these stories and make them into whatever they want, like the strong delusion type thing?
Maybe so. I think it would be more the former than the latter. I think it's sometimes we do overcomplicate metaphors and analogies and parables and so forth, and people do that like with the book of Revelation quite a bit and all the symbolism. It's not necessarily going to be a one-to-one, you know, comparison or ratio and so forth, and so we need to just make sure we're getting the ultimate point that he's trying to get across to us. The ultimate desire, though, I think the main reason, as he points out here, as to why he spoke in parables, was to try to get the people that really were interested to come to him and follow him. He did so in a way that would separate out those who were not interested. And the disciples, as we've already pointed out, they asked him about these parables, and he was willing to explain. He was willing to talk with them about the parables. And he would have done that, I believe, he would have done that with any one of the multitude if they had come to him and said, "Hey, I heard you today and you were talking about this, but I'm not exactly sure what you meant. You obviously had something in mind, something I was supposed to understand. I'm not getting it. Help me understand." Can you imagine Jesus refusing to explain that to anybody? No, that's what he wants. And the disciples were blessed because they were hearing and they were seeing. And they were willing to go after that. So he does explain, verse 18 through 23, the parable. I'm not going to spend much time on this because this is something that we're all probably very, very familiar with. But I do want to say this. While this parable does not mention specifically the kingdom of heaven, all the other parables in Matthew 13 do speak of the kingdom of heaven. You know, the kingdom of heaven is like. And then he puts forth a parable. I believe that while it's not specifically stated, it would still relate to this idea that you have the word being that message of the kingdom that is being sowed, that is being spread, that is being taught. And it's about the response of people to that message of the kingdom. And it's not that 75% of the people are not going to respond. We don't need to think of it as 25, 25, 25, and 25%. But it's just that the majority of the people are not going to respond in a way that will be fruitful. And there's different reasons for that. Some of the time, Satan comes along and snatches that message before it has time to germinate and produce any kind of crop. Sometimes it's because people allow, they don't have much spiritual depth. They don't have really any kind of foundation. It sounds good at the first, but then temptations come and trials come and they wilt, he says. And then other people allow the things of the world to choke out the message and not produce fruit, the riches and cares of this life and so forth. But then others, they really grab hold of it. They see it and they let it germinate in their heart. It changes them and they work and they work and they produce fruit. That is really the way we see, even still today, the response to the message of the kingdom. Unfortunately, some people never never see it. And some people we witness, they will bloom for a while, but then fade away. And that's just the way it is, unfortunately. Okay. As far as sowers are concerned, what's an application we can take away from this? If we are sowers, if we're sowing the seed of the kingdom as we sing, what's an application that we can take away? Sow constantly, Amy says. Okay, very good. What else? No matter what kind of ground. Okay, just keep sowing. You can't make it sprout. Yeah, you can do things to help the process along, but really, there's a lot of other conditions that are beyond your control, and they have to play a part in it too. Yeah. While it may be true that you can look at a piece of land and tell which is better soil than the other, you can't do that with humans, can you? People fool us all the time. People that you think are honest and they want to do what's right, and they certainly, if they were taught the truth, man, they would take it and they would be on fire for the Lord. They never do. And then there are other people whom you think, my word, bottom of the bottom here, scraping the barrel. This person has no desire for spiritual matters, and yet something happens and they become the most zealous disciple of the Lord. You can't tell. You can't tell what kind of soul it is. Yeah, they were not, they were indiscriminate with where they sowed the seed. They were just putting it wherever they could, just flinging the seed wherever. We don't need to discriminate where we sow the seed.
We need to prepare the soil.
We can take some efforts to prepare the soil, Linda says. And that is true. There are things that we can do to help that along. I think that all goes into the idea of sowing the seed. You know, what all that would entail would include some of the preparations and the efforts that you make even after the seed is in the ground. I mean, you don't just tell somebody the gospel message and then never say another word to them. I mean, there's a constant effort that needs to be made in order to try to get that seed to germinate and produce fruit. When you plant a garden, even today, you got to go out there and make the soil good to, yeah, right. So, there are things that we can do to help that process along. Okay. So this parable of the sower, while the multitudes did not get this explanation, remember, try to put yourself in their shoes, and one of the multitudes, what is he talking about? Well, we have the privilege of seeing and reading what the meaning of it was. They did not, unless they would have come to Jesus and asked. Okay? All right. Any questions or comments before we move on to the next parable? Okay. So obviously the parable of the sower is one thing he said while in the boat, just a little way out from the shore, teaching the multitudes. When this conversation took place about with the disciples asking, why do you speak to them in parables? Obviously, it would have had to happen after he was done teaching them many things. So don't read through this and think that this conversation we just talked about in verses 10 through 17 took place immediately after the parable, because there are still other parables that he is telling them. And probably while he was in the boat, such as the parable of the wheat and the tares, verse 24. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in this field, but while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. Just a weed that at certain stages looked very, very similar to wheat. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, "Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?" He said to them, "An enemy has done this." The servants said to him, "Do you want us then to go and gather them up?" But he said, "No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, 'First gather together the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Period. That's it. No explanation. You've just heard that for the first time. What on earth are you talking about, Jesus? No explanation. Another scenario from the farming industry, from the agriculture, from the life that they were familiar with. They knew what wheat was. They knew what tares were. They knew why an enemy would do that to devalue the crop and cause all kinds of efforts and heartache and problems for the enemy. The tares, and the reason why the enemy would choose the tares is because it resembled the wheat, it looked like the wheat. And it wouldn't be until it was too late, until close to harvest time, that the farmer would recognize, man, that crop is wasted, or at least a good portion of it is wasted. It's got all these tares in it. But if you're one of the multitude and you're hearing this, yeah, why is Jesus talking about this? Again, you would have to have the inclination and the desire, like the disciples in verse 36, to come to him and say, "Please explain this parable to us." I mean, the disciples didn't get it, and you can't blame them. I mean, would you have gotten it if you hadn't gone and asked Jesus what it meant? If we didn't have Matthew 13, verse 36 through 43, would you understand the parable of the wheat and the tares? Probably not. I mean, people would have probably tried to come up with all kinds of explanations, but we wouldn't know for sure what Jesus was talking about. So get the order of the events here. We'll talk about the explanation in just a moment. But first he says this about the parable about the wheat and the tares, and then he talks about the mustard seed. And he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds. But when it is grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." No explanation. Not even to the disciples. We got to work those out on our own. And again, he spoke another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal till it was all leavened." Again, no explanation, not even to the disciples. We're going to have to figure this out on our own. We can't ask Jesus, "Hey, can you explain the parable of the mustard seed and the leaven to us?" Okay. All these things, and we'll talk about the explanation here, though, and what he most likely is talking about in just a moment. All these things, verse 34, Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable he did not speak to them, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, "I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world," quoting from Psalm 78. So he's speaking to this multitude with this type of teaching method and weeding the people out. And let's talk very briefly about the parable of the tares, taking a look at the explanation that he gives to us. He makes it clear that the field is the world, verse 38. "Good seeds are the sons of the kingdom. Tares are the sons of the wicked one. Enemy is the devil. Harvest is the end of the age. Reapers are the angels." Okay, so he does point out every single thing here and the corresponding meaning. What was the Jewish expectation of the kingdom? We've talked about this at great length. Let's just quickly review it. What did the Jews expect to happen with the coming kingdom that had been prophesied. Be what? Okay, be earthly, number one. What else? Okay, be throwing off the Roman oppression, which necessitated the Messiah do what? I mean, or what kind of king would he be? Yeah, like David, a fighting king, a military king, right? Okay, so there would be all kinds of judgment upon the enemies of God through the Messiah, and also this would happen fairly quickly. I mean, when you have a war, yeah, it's going to take some time, and wars don't happen overnight, you know, victory doesn't happen overnight, but in the grand scheme of things, it's something that's going to be fairly quick. He's going to come in, and he's going to throw off the Roman oppression, destroy the Romans. When Jesus established his kingdom, or began to establish his kingdom, rather, in Acts chapter 2, he began his rule, but what do we see? We still see that it's not completed. It's been almost 2,000 years. And his kingdom is still not completely established. His rule, his authority. That's what we need to think of when we think of kingdom. Don't think church. There are obviously some correlation there, but don't think church. Think authority and rule and dominion. That's what kingdom is talking about. And he has not yet put all enemies under his feet, has he? Okay, so think Jewish expectation of the kingdom and think now what he's saying about what the kingdom of heaven is really like. Well, you have the wicked that are existing right alongside the righteous. Jewish expectation of the kingdom was the wicked were going to be punished and taken away right away, right, by the Messiah. And Jesus says, no, they're going to exist, coexist for a while. Until when? When will the separation take place? According to this parable. At the harvest. Which is, he said, what? What did he say the harvest is? The end of the age. End of the world. Right? Okay? So, that's not going to happen until the end of the age, and the angels will be the one that will go and separate that out. We'll finish up the parable of the tares on Sunday. If you have not completely read Matthew 13, please do so before next Sunday, and we'll talk about the rest of the parables. Thank you.